the broad highway, right, into the spiritual life really is broad, roomy, and all-inclusive, right? When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't even know that God was real or that God existed, and I didn't know how to pray. And now I'm sitting here with 36 years of continuous sobriety, and I have a deep and effective and current and active relationship with a God who I don't understand well at all. But I cannot deny the body of evidence that he is alive and well and working in my life and in all of your life.
Well, hello, friends of Bill W. and other friends. You have landed on Sober Speak. My name is John M. I am an alcoholic, and we are glad you are all here, especially newcomers. Newcomers, that is, both to recovery as a whole and newcomers to this podcast. Sober Speak is a podcast about recovery centered around the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. My job here on Sober Speak is simple. My job is to provide a platform to the amazing stories of recovery all around us. Consider Sober Speak, if you will, your meeting between meetings. Please remember, we do not speak for AA or any 12-step community. We represent only ourselves. We are here to share our experience, strength, and hope with those who wish to come along for the ride. Take what you want and leave the rest at the curb for the trash man to pick up. Alas, we doth meet again. Greetings from Studio AA, deep, I say, in the heart of Texas. That was the voice of Miss Deb H that you heard at the beginning of this here episode number 341 as a follow-up to last week, her original episode or first part of her talk, however you want to phrase it. Part one was last week and part two is this week. And you're going to hear so much more from Deb in un momento, but first things first, this here episode is brought to you by Will and Brad. What, you may ask, did Will and Brad do? They went to our humble little website, scrolled to the bottom of the page, clicked on the little yellow donate tab, and they made a contribution via PayPal. And this here episode is coming right out to you, Will and Brad. We're going to let all the other folks listen in, but we appreciate your generosity. So, just real quick, I'm going to share a little bit about what I did this week. I've shared on the past couple episodes, I was going through some little bit of a challenge, right? And it's all relative. But I was going through some challenges, and most of it, and the majority of it, is fear-based. Some resentment in there, but mainly fear-based. But I decided this week to go ahead and, gosh, do what the program suggests that we do. I got out a pen and a paper, and I've heard my friend David G. talk about this before. He talks about, you know, we have the tools, and sometimes you just forget to take out a piece of paper and a pen and do what it says to do in the big book and write it out. And it's amazing how much clarity that pen and paper versus just talking about it will bring to oneself, or at least it did in my case. I've been talking to my sponsor a lot, doing a lot of praying, a lot of meditating. You know, it's interesting when you go through difficult times, how it, at least for me, it prompts me to find new ways and other ways to get closer to the God of my understanding. And anyway, that's what I've been doing this week. I mean, other things. It wasn't just a four-step all week. I've got a pretty busy life, but I did take time to do that. Now, on to Deb H, part two. This one is called The Highway is Broad, Roomy, and All-Inclusive. As I mentioned earlier, this is the follow-up to last week's episode, part one. Buckle up and enjoy the ride on this one. Deb is chock full of pearls of wisdom. This is one of those where I suggest that you, if you can be stationary, or if you're listening to it while you're driving, go back and listen to it again. Pay close attention and take lots of notes. One of my favorite quotes that she had from this episode is, or from my recording with her, is, "Surrender is a process, not an event." She also says, "Rely on the relationship I have with God, not the one I want." Isn't that good? Isn't that good? I thought about this week, like, rely on the relationship that I have with God, not the one I want. There was something that was just profound about that personally to me. We talk about the tragedy that occurred with her husband. And then there was an individual that let Deb know that it was okay to be angry with God. But then Walter provided another way to process that tragedy that occurred. And you want to be sure to listen in on that. Once again, make sure you take notes on this one. Listen to it all the way through, and we will have plenty of listener feedback at the end of this here episode. Enjoy Deb H. from Akron, Ohio. Okay, everybody. Excuse me. My voice just gave out. So we are back again with the one and only Deb H. So Deb, I'm going to ask you to go ahead, introduce yourself, give your sobriety date if you wish, tell people where you live in this great land of ours, and then we'll get started with a little bit more of your story, please.
Okay, great. Nice to be back. Thank you. My name is Deb H. I'm a real alcoholic. I live in Akron, Ohio, and my sobriety date is March 15th, 1987.
Okay, so for those of you who did not hear Deb's first episode, first of all, you want to go back and do that. But we talked about several different things, right? We talked about her visit to Dr. Bob's house at one point, what that was like when she was first sober, and you got to go back and hear that story. We talked about her Harley Davidson that she rides around a lot, her alcoholic dad. And then when we left off last time, her and her sister had just gotten out of treatment. Deb was all excited about getting loaded with her sister after they both got out of treatment. But her sister kind of spoiled the fun a little bit. In other words, she came back and said, "I had a spiritual experience," and now Deb is having to deal with that. And before we go on that road though, there, I do just want to ask you another quick question. You had said that you lived in my neck of the woods at one point, right? In the Dallas area. Were you down here for work, or what were you down here for?
I was down there for work. Yeah, I've gotten to live all over the country. I've had 13 relocations. I've lived in 9 different states, and I move around for projects and for random assignments. And I was in the DFW area because I was entering into aviation, and so I was working for the DFW airport so that I could learn aviation at one of the biggest airports in the U.S.
What was your experience like down here in this part of the country? Did you like it?
From a work perspective, it was everything that it needed to be. From a weather perspective, you can keep it. It's really hot down there a lot, and there's no water to be found. If I'm going to be that hot, I want to be near the water. And your traffic, again, you can keep it. It was a 2-hour Harley ride just to get outside of the footprint to where I could actually get into sixth gear. And you don't have really good hills.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, I lived in Wisconsin for a while, which is similar to Akron in terms of the weather. And I really loved it. I like the four seasons. I like, you know, the snow, the whole nine yards. And I've always told people that Texas, I don't know. I mean, we have tons of people that are moving here, right? And I've always said it's flat and hot. If I wasn't from here, I probably wouldn't move here. But it's also one of those things, once it gets in your system, it's hard to get out. But All right. So let's go ahead and pick it up again from the last episode. Once again, we were talking, you had just, you know, found out that your sister had this spiritual experience, and then you were about to go into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting for the first time, I believe. So talk to me about your entree into the rooms of AA and what that was like.
Okay. We're still living really close to Akron, Ohio. So we're going to meetings in and around the Akron area. My ma would drop us off at the meeting, always 15 minutes before the meeting was to start. I would stand outside long enough to be late. So I'm entering into every room late because I'm just not interested, right, in all of the chit-chat and the handshaking and all of that stuff. Like, we did that at the very first meeting, and I was like, why are people touching me, right? And why are you looking at me? And I don't like coffee, thank you very much, and all of that, right?
And are you 15 or 16 at this point? Is that right?
I'm 15.
You're 15 years old. So You've got to be one of the only 15, if not the only 15-year-old in there. And I guess your sister's close to 17 or something like that at this point. And so are y'all the youngest kids, if you will, in the rooms?
We absolutely were the youngest. And we were the only teenagers when we got there. We were it. And we walked in and everybody's just kind of looking at us and we're looking at them and I'm not sure what I'm supposed to do. And it became really clear to me that they were welcoming to us, and they looked at us kind of, I mean, we're a little bit of a novelty. Right. They weren't really sure if we were there for real or not.
Yeah.
And I wasn't, and my sister was, but my sister wasn't qualified to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, she never even drank. Right. So she's sitting in the wrong 12-step room. I'm in the right room, but don't want to be there. And so we were kind of a tough, you know, we were a tough crowd.
Right.
We really were. And my sister was trying to do all the right things, right? She would get there, she would walk in on time and all of that kind of stuff. And I'm hanging out outside so that I'm late going into every meeting. I didn't like coffee, but I would have 3 cups at every meeting. And so I was just up, down, up, down. I was just busy. We were still smoking cigarettes in AA back then, right? It's 36 years ago. And I didn't smoke when I got to AA, so I had to learn. And, so I did. And so I would sit in AA meeting. Oh yeah. I mean, you got to fit in. And so I'm using my regular indoor voice in the middle of an AA meeting. Like somebody's on the podium giving a pitch and I'm like, hey buddy, you got to smoke? Like just right. Just being, and most of the meetings, and I say this and it's still true. Like my home group was this morning. My home group is, we meet in a church basement with a hard floor and metal folding chairs. And when you drag a metal folding chair across like a concrete floor, it makes a lot of noise. And to me, that just brought me joy. Absolutely brought me joy because I didn't want to be there and I was going to make it miserable for everyone else. I mean, because I was just self-centered to the extreme. And I would leave every meeting early. Like I went a couple of times, you guys pray a lot. I wasn't interested, right? I mean, you open with a prayer, you close with the prayer. It was just nonstop, you know, I was like, oh, good Lord. And so I would sneak out of the room when you guys would get ready to circle up, I'm out of there. Mm-hmm. And I was going to meetings, like I said, in and around the Akron area. And Mac Shadburn was an old timer then, and I would have sworn to you he was the president of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was old. He had been sober since Christ was a child. And he ran Alcoholics Anonymous. He absolutely did. And he was loud and he would cuss and snarl and was always talked with cigarettes in his fingers. And his nemesis was this old gal. Her name was Jane. And Jane was as old as he was, as sober as long as he was. And Jane, like they would carry her into the meetings. They would park, like she always had the assigned parking place right by the door. And somebody would drive her to the meeting. And then they would go out and they would put her into these wooden high back chairs, not the folding ones. And they would carry her down the stairs into the church basement and would place her by the podium. And she smoked cigarettes on an extender. And people would line up to talk to her. She was that old timer, and you'll know, right? There's a couple of different kinds, right? There's the grumpy kind who is just looking for a reason to, you know, yell or snarl or look at the meme.
Right.
That was Mac, right? And then there's the kind where she literally took a genuine interest in the lives of others. Mm. And so people would line up to talk to her because they just couldn't wait because she wasn't like a physically demonstrative, right? But she would remember that something big was happening in your life and she would ask you about it and want to hear the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she would hear that your daughter was having you over for Sunday dinner and you hadn't been allowed over there for 15 or 16 years.
Mm-hmm.
And she would make you a little casserole as a side dish so that you didn't show up empty-handed. She was that kind of old timer.
Yeah.
And they were running Alcoholics Anonymous. They were absolutely running it. And Mac was always sitting by the door that you had to go in and out of to get in and out of all of the meetings. And so he's the guy that I'm trying to avoid, right? And not make eye contact with and not touch and all of that kind of stuff. And I never went up to the front of the room to talk to Jane because in my mind, like I can be rejected by anybody, anytime, anywhere. I'm not going to wait on a line to get rejected.
Right.
And I knew that they were not happy with my behavior. And I, quite frankly, I didn't care. Anyway, so I'm going to meetings like that, acting poorly like that for some months. And finally, I was leaving the meeting one night, you know, you guys are getting ready to circle up. So I'm scurrying down the back wall and I bumped into something and I turned to see what I bumped into. And Mac had gotten up out of his chair and was standing with his arms crossed in the doorway. And he just looked down at me and he said, "Get in the circle."
Mm-hmm.
And I just looked at him and he flipped his little finger forward. And I was like, okay. So I went and I got in the circle. And as soon as the prayer was over, I went to leave and Mac was still standing in the doorway blocking my way. And he looked at me and he said, "Are you alcoholic?" And I gave him the only answer that I had at 15 years old. I gave him my best full attitude shoulder shrug. No words. And he looked at me and he said, "Can you control your drinking?" And again, I gave him the exact same shoulder shrug. Because quite frankly, I never tried to control my drinking. There were several days when I tried to not start. But once I swallowed it, I knew it was on. So what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, so I gave him the two shoulder shrugs. And he reached in his back pocket and he took a $5 bill out of his back pocket and he handed it to me. And he said, "Here's $5. This will get you started. Go find out. We're tired of you treating Alcoholics Anonymous like a joke.
Mm-hmm.
Go drink and try to control it. If it doesn't work, you get back here. If it does work, I never want to see you again." And so I went back into the room and found my sister. And I was like, "Hey, go get your $5, man. We are out of here." Right? I was just so grateful, right? Because somebody in authority finally knew what I really needed. And anyway, that was March of 87.
Wow.
And yeah. And I finally got to relapse, which is all I wanted, because I was sitting in the room with the solution and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I couldn't touch it. I couldn't see it. I couldn't feel it. I couldn't want it.
Mm-hmm.
But I was there. It's the most fascinating thing. And anyway, so I went out and but you guys had gotten in my head, right? Because I was like, okay, I am going to keep the cap. Right? I'm going to control my drinking, which means to me, I'm going to keep the cap to the bottle.
Keep the cap. Gotcha.
Keep the cap. So I'm going to have 3 long pulls off the bottle and a couple of beers, and I'm just going to get enough going on so that, because remember, I hadn't had any relief. I am back to being terrified all the time, because when I'm sober, I'm not okay. And so I'm terrified. I'm not exhaling. My shoulders are back on my ears. My little hands are in balled up in fists. I'm living life on the balls of my feet again. I am terrified, and I hate me, and I hate you, and I hate my life, and I'm physically sober, and I don't like it, and I have no relief, no steps, no God, no fellowship, nothing, even though I'm going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous all the time.
Hmm.
And so this drinking I was like, okay, I got it, right? I'm not going to drink the way I used to drink. I'm not going to drink to oblivion. I learned my lesson. People overreact when I drink that way. It takes me down dark places, dark paths to dark people. I'm not going to do any of that anymore. I don't want to add to the shame that I'm carrying with me every day, right? So I'm not going to drink like that. And anyway, and so I had a plan. And I went out to execute that plan, and I swallowed alcohol. And what you guys had been saying became so clear to me. And that is that the more I drink, the thirstier I'm going to get. The more I drink, the thirstier I get. I swallowed that alcohol, and the phenomena of craving was triggered. And yes, my shoulders began to come off my ears. And yes, my hands unfurled a bit. And yes, I got to exhale a smidge. But I couldn't stop. And so once again, I drink until it's all gone. I'm face down in a mud puddle. I come to the next day. Somehow I had gotten home. I'm crawling out of my last blackout. I make it into the bathroom. I look at myself straight on in the mirror for the first time in a couple of years. And I heard two things. I'm standing there sick and filthy and black and blue, having no recall of what had happened. None. And I hear two things. One is that I hear Max Shadburn's voice. If it doesn't work, you get back here. And then I heard another voice that I didn't recognize, and it was the truth slipping in. And what I heard was, you are always going to drink just like this, which was the absolute truth. Mm-hmm. And that morning, I fully conceded to my innermost self that I had alcoholism. That was the moment. Now, that's surrender number one, but it requires surrender number two, which is I had to surrender to the fact that the treatment for my alcoholism was a life in Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm. And I had been in Alcoholics Anonymous, and everybody in AA was mad at me. That's how I would tell the story.
You know, there's another piece that I've heard you talk about in the past, and well, I don't think we covered it during the last episode, but you talked about that house that was across the tracks that you used to go to sometime, and kind of how you got into trouble there. It was just kind of and it made me think of it when you said dark places and dark people and all that sort of stuff. Talk about that house that was across the tracks.
Yeah. So again, in the little railroad towns, right side of tracks, wrong side of tracks. So on the wrong side of the tracks, in this little town anyway, there were these row houses. And in these row houses, that's where people who were flying below the radar, trying to avoid detection or arrest somehow, somewhere, you know, picking up day labor kinds of things, they would all find them. They were flop houses on the wrong side of the tracks. Mm. And there were just these people there that I should have never met, should have never laid my eyes on them. And they were the people that thought it was perfectly fine to give a 13 or 14 year old her own fifth of vodka and not ask any questions. Mm. And I would cross those tracks. I would sneak across those tracks often, daily there for a little while. And I would go because I knew where my bottle would be. And they were consistent. And I would go and I would drink and I would be face down in the mud puddle. And there were things that happen at the dark house on the wrong side of the tracks. Wow. With the people. And there was but it was the only place that I could go to when I'm 14 years old and I need a bottle. And there was no other way for me to get it that day. And I knew where I needed to go to get it.
Wow.
And that's just part of the reality of being a kid who has alcoholism.
Right. Okay, so and so let's get, and I'm sorry, I kind of got you off track, but now that you're kind of, you've made these two surrenders in Alcoholics Anonymous, right? So a lot has happened between, oh gosh, you know, the last 36 years now. You tell me, where do you want to start? What have been some significant milestones for you during that period?
So, in those first several years, so that group of people that Mac and Jane both belonged to, right? They decided that they were going to save my life. Mac had called an emergency group conscience meeting and said, look, you know, these girls got to go. I don't even think that they're alcoholic. Mm. But they're ruining our meetings. They're being a complete disruption. They got to go. We have to encourage them to go try to control their drinking, that kind of thing. Right.
Wow.
It says in the book, yep. Right. Go try to control your drinking. And if it doesn't work, kind of thing.
So, you must have been very disruptive. It sounds like.
Oh, I was so disruptive.
And was your sister as much of a, by the way, your sister, what did she keep going to the AA meetings? Did she go to NA? What happened there?
No, she relapsed also. And she never came back. Oh. Yeah. She relapsed also, never came back. She graduated high school shortly after relapsing. She went into the Navy, and her life has been a different journey than mine.
Okay. Gotcha. God bless her.
Yeah, a very different journey. Yep.
Okay. Yep. All right. So now you're take me forward from there. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
So this group, right? He has the group conscience meeting, and they all agree that I got to go because I'm being disruptive and all this kind of stuff. And thank God, you know, in the service structure in Alcoholics Anonymous, if there is a dissenting opinion about a topic, they will allow the minority opinion to have the floor before they close the topic. Mm-hmm. And in my case, there was one dissenter in that room. He was an old guy named Bill Long. And Bill Long was super old and had been sober a long time too. And Bill Long never ever talked, right? He's that old guy that you would never hear him on a podium. He's never going to make a comment at a discussion meeting. He's not going to read if he's at a literature meeting. He's just going to sit and listen. But he's also that guy where his service work in Alcoholics Anonymous is to get there early and to be sitting by the coffee pot. Because anytime that any of us would walk into a room, we would look around, find the coffee pot. And if Bill was sitting by the coffee pot, we knew that everything was all right. And that was Bill's job in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was the dissenting guy in the room that night. And so they said, do you want to say anything about that? Because everybody's like, yeah, they got to go, right? She's just, you know, she's being terrible. And Bill, as the story was relayed to me, Bill stands up in the back of the room and he said, the way I see it, God gave us those girls. Therefore, they're our responsibility. And we should try to put them onto the program of Alcoholics Anonymous before we toss them about. And change the room on a dime. And Max said, yes, but if they don't think that they're alcoholic, they need to go sort that out. And they said, no, you're right. You're right. Because what does it say in the first step in the 12 and 12, right? Who wishes to admit complete defeat, right? We're not going to come all the way in and sit all the way down if we don't really believe we need to be here.
Right.
And we're certainly not going to do the heavy lifting of an inventory if we don't believe we need to be here. Right. And so he was like, yeah, you're right. And so anyway, but Bill is the guy who stands up for us. I don't know any of this. Right. And so Mac, you know, quote unquote, tosses us out of Alcoholics Anonymous. Right. That's the way I tell the story. And anyway, and so when we come back that next day, right, I crawl into Alcoholics Anonymous that evening. I got there on time. I sat in the middle. I had one cup of coffee. I bummed all of my cigarettes before the meeting started, so I wasn't talking during the pitch. And I got in your circle at the end. And Mac was standing in the doorway when I went to leave the room. Because as soon as the circle's over, as soon as the Lord's Prayer is done, I'm out. And Mac is standing back in the doorway again. And he looked at me and he said, did you get a sponsor? And I looked at him and I just shook my head no. And he flipped his finger forward again, right? So I had to walk back into the room. I walk up to every woman in the room, every woman. And I said, will you sponsor me? And they all went, no. Oh, honey. No, no, no. So I went to leave and Max said, well, did you get a sponsor? And I said, no one in here will sponsor me. And he said, that is a lie. I said, I'm not asking her.
Oh, yeah, I know you're going to.
And you know where he's sending me, don't you? He's sending me up to the front to talk to Jane.
Right.
Right. And of course, so I have to wait on a line to be able to talk to Jane. And it's finally my turn, right? And you know how when you're doing something in Alcoholics Anonymous for the very first time that you really don't want to do, it's like it happens in slow motion.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, she inhales, right? Because she smokes the cigarettes on the extender, right? She takes an inhale and that takes 2 minutes, right? And then the exhale is at least a minute and a half, if not 2 minutes. And I just looked down at her and I said, will you sponsor me? And she just looked at me and she said, honey, why should I? And you know what? That was a reasonable question to ask based on the way I'd been acting. And instead of telling her where to shove that cigarette extender, I looked at her and I said, because I need to be sober and I don't know how. And I guarantee you, I didn't have that thought. And she said, well, I guess you'll be doing some things differently now, won't you? And that was that. And the next day at 7 o'clock in the evening, there's this enormous car that comes floating in my driveway. And we're not expecting anyone. And I walk out and I knock on the window and there's two old guys sitting in the front seat of that car. It's an old Ford LTD from the 70s. And they roll down the window and I said, can I help you guys? And they said, Jane sent us, get in the car. And I said, no, I'm good. I went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous yesterday. I'm grounded for the rest of my life. I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to be sober tonight. I don't need to go. And they just looked at me and said, Jane sent us. Get in the car. And I went in the house and I said, Ma, AA's here. And she was like, okay, honey, have fun. And I was like, what is happening in my life right now? And I went out and I got in the back seat of this car and off we went to an Alcoholics Anonymous. What that group also did was that it took the 7 days of the week and two members of that group took responsibility for a day of the week. And it was their job to come and pick me up and take me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm-hmm. And after every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, we went to the donut shop. And at the donut shop, at 9:30 or 10 o'clock at night, you would eat powdered sugar donuts, drink fully caffeinated coffee, smoke cigarettes, like somehow North Carolina was going to figure out a way to secede from the Union. He gets tobacco with it. And we would rehash everything we just talked about at the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous again and again. And if you were new, like I was, they would put me at a tiny table off to the side with two people and a big book and sometimes a 12 and 12. And they had divided up the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and they were sharing the responsibility of putting me onto the program. Mm-hmm. And in those donut shops, after meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for the first 2.5 years of my sobriety, they introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous and placed me into and onto the program of Alcoholics Anonymous out of the literature. And I'm so grateful that they did. So grateful that they did. And they gave me an experience, not only with the literature, but also with the freedom that comes from actually working the steps. And they taught me how to pray sitting in the donut shop. They took my book one night, like I was, you know, in there belly aching about something. And one of the old guys said, you know, he was like a broken record, right? Did you pray about it? Did you pray about it? Did you pray about it? And finally, one night, I was like, dude, I don't know how. And he said, give me your book. And so I slid my big book across the table and he opened it and he underlined and highlighted all the tiny little prayers that are between pages 60 and 90.
Yeah.
And he closed it and he slid it back across the table and he said, pick one and try it. And Mac, of course, is sitting on the other side of the donut shop, right, with his great hearing. And he said, on your knees, little one, on your knees. Right? And so.
Little one.
Oh, my God. You know, they're calling me little one, but, you know, I'm 5'9". You know, I was 5'9 back then, too. But anyway. But they tricked me onto the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is truly that attraction rather than promotion, right? Now, I will tell you, and it's true, I didn't really feel like I had a choice, right? Like because they were showing up, I had to get in the car. Mm-hmm. And then I was kind of at their mercy, right? Whatever donut shop they were going to, I was headed there with them. And I didn't get home until they were done. And when I was at the donut shop, like, they wouldn't talk to me if I wasn't like sitting at the right table with the right people doing the right thing. But the beauty about that time, and I have been accused of kind of romanticizing the old timers of the day. But since I moved back to Akron about 3 years ago, I have run into some people who are around back then too, who were within their first couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I was like, so I tell the story about the donut shop and they're like, oh yeah, you remember the one on such and such street and blah, blah, blah. And that waitress was and whatever. And remember, that's where they always took you to do the fourths.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So my ability to remember them is, it's really not romanticized, and I'm grateful for that. Yeah. Right. Because it really was as magical as I remember it being.
So that's great. I want to talk a little bit about some of your, I've heard you talk about it a little bit before, some of your relationships, your marriages within Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, that it's not all, you know, roses and such, however you want to phrase that. So talk to me about some of your relationships that you've had during Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah, thank you. The process of recovery that I experienced through the 12 steps and through deepening my relationship with God, I always say, you know, surrender is a process, not an event. You know, and so through the years, right, I've had to surrender all kinds of things. I mean, if you look at step 6 and 7, right? Step 6 and 7 is a constant process of discover, surrender, discover, surrender, discover, surrender, and choose a new behavior. And I will often say, you know, I surrendered a lot, willingly and quickly, right? I surrendered whether or not I went to AA, whether or not I drank, where I went to school, how I went to school. I mean, they made me go to college. Right? They kicked me out of the nest and made me go to college. But I surrendered, you know, where I worked, how I worked, all of it. Every time more was revealed, that is a call to have more, to deepen my surrender. Mm-hmm. Right? It says, you know, great events will come to pass, right? More will be revealed for you and countless others. Every time more is revealed, it's another opportunity to deepen my surrender. And it's deepening my surrender into the realm of the Spirit. Right? It's that process of dying to self so that I can connect more fully to the love and to the grace of God. And so that I can connect more fully and more authentically to you, a member of my community, so that I can truly be of service. And so that I can realize the fact that we are all connected and we are all one. But, you know, getting to that point, I surrendered every single area of my life willingly, except for romantic relationships. I don't know if this is what you want to talk about, but this is where we're going. Yeah. So I surrendered every area. I surrendered every area of my life over time, pretty willingly for the most part, because I don't like to hurt. But romantic relationships, I was really sure that God didn't know what handsome was, right? I was really sure. And I was like, I am not, just because I'm spiritual does not mean that I'm going to get stuck with somebody that I don't think is handsome. Anyway, and so I would pick my own boyfriends, I would pick husbands, I would pick whatever, right? And I had no foundation for how to have an actual healthy relationship, just none. I mean, I'd been married and divorced in Alcoholics Anonymous and all of that. And it looked like I had surrendered every area of my life except this one, right? If you followed me around, it was like, man, she is really together and super successful and all of these things. And except this one area, like, what is going on over there, right? Anyway, I went through, I was about 18 years sober, and I had finally, I mean, God just comes to me from time to time and gets it over involved in my life. And I go through a process of spiritual rearrangement. And this time, like, he was just wrestling me to the ground, and he's like, I have perfect love to give you, and you continue to block me. I reached this point where I couldn't be comfortable unless I was on my knees in prayer and meditation. And it was several weeks. And I'm on my knees in prayer and I'm like, God, I don't know what you want from me. What do you want? Like, I'm sober a long time. I'm sponsoring people. I've gotten the education that you've wanted me to get. I do really important work for important organizations and agencies. Like, I'm doing it all. I've been on call for 20 years. Like, I haven't slept all night and I don't know how long. Like, what do you want from me? And he just kept saying, I have perfect love to give you and you continue to block me. And I'm like, okay, I hear you, but you can't have that. Because I was finally dating this lovely man. His name was Lee. And he was a United States Marine. He was a major in the Marines, and he was beautiful, right? 6'1", bald hair or bald head, blue eyes. He was kind. He was a natural leader. Although a little introverted, people followed him just because he was walking somewhere. He was awesome. And we were best friends. We rode Harleys together. We golfed together. I mean, he was great. And it was finally right, like the right guy for the right reasons and all of that. And God came to me and he said, look, he said, I want you to be with someone who loves me the way you do. And it was true that the one thing that Lee didn't have is he didn't have an active current relationship with a God of his understanding. And he wasn't a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So his life didn't depend on it. Or so I would have told you then. And I was like, look, as long as I'm going to AA and I'm praying and I'm doing the things that I need to do, it is none of my business what his spiritual life is or is not. Right? I can be spiritual enough for both of us. I can, you know, whatever. I had it fully justified. But God was just having his way with me. And he was like, no, I have perfect love to give you. Stop blocking me. And anyway, and so it reached a point to where, like I said, I wasn't comfortable unless I was praying and meditating. I knew what he wanted. I knew that he wanted me to let Lee go. I knew that he wanted me to trust him, like all the way, like go all in and just have what he wants me to have, be with who he wants me to be with. I knew that that's where, and I was just like, no, like I finally got it right. Have you seen him? Right? I mean, there's nothing wrong here, right? There's nothing wrong here. Why do I have to give him up? Anyway, I was speaking at the Louisiana State Convention, and I was just an exhausted, tearful mess because I'm in the middle of this spiritual fight with God, and I'm not surrendering, and he's not either, right? And so he's after me, and I'm like, no. And so I'm speaking at this conference, and I run into this old timer. His name is Walter. And Walter lives in Houston, Texas. And Walter and I meet there and we're hanging out. And Walter comes to me and he says, you know, Deb, he said, I don't speak at a lot of these things. He said, but I find that when God does bring me to one of these to talk, he said, I'm sent there very specifically for one person. And I think that's you. And I said, well, why would you have been sent here for me? I'm fine. Everything is fine in my world. Mm-hmm. Right. And I'm a speaker too. Everything is, you know, and he was like, he's like, I don't know anything about that. He said, I've just met you. He said, I'd just like to tell you to sit up front by my wife on Sunday morning when I talk and bring tissues because I think God has a message for you.
Oh, wow.
I know. And so I did as I was told because he's one of my elders. And so I sat up front with his wife and she had tissues for me. And I hadn't slept in several days and I'm in the middle of this stuff, right? Because growing spiritually is not always easy. And Walter delivers this message to me, and it was powerful, absolutely powerful. And I knew that I needed to be the one to surrender my side of the argument. I knew that I needed to go home and to let Lee go and see what God had in mind. And it broke my heart, just broke my heart. And I went home and I did that. I had the conversation with Lee, and I was like, look, I got to go. And he was like, what do you mean you got to go? I said, God wants a deeper relationship with me. And I think you're in my way. He wants me to be with someone who loves God the way I love God. And you don't have an active relationship with him. And Lee looked at me and he said, "Are you sure that it's not just another man?" And I was like, "Oh God, no, that would be easy." Right? This isn't easy. Anyway, so I broke up with him and let him go we were broken up for a couple of months. And he comes and finds me, and I had this hour on Wednesday nights at 7 o'clock where I would sit in this little Catholic chapel, in the town where I was living for 1 hour. It was all mine. And I would sit there in prayer and meditation. And I would have these deep and wonderful interactions with God on Wednesday nights during my hour. And Lee showed up there one night. And he said, "Look," he said, I understand, like, because I was going to become Catholic because there were some tools in the Catholic toolbox that I needed to have access to. That's where God was pushing me. Anyway, so I was doing all of these things spiritually that I was being asked to do. And Lee said, I know that you're going to become Catholic. He said, and so I am too. And he asked me if I would marry him. And he asked me if he could go on the spiritual journey with me. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did. We spent the next year getting ourselves aligned inside of a faith that we could share, which was the Catholic faith. Mm-hmm. We developed a spiritual language in our relationship. We put prayer at the top of our list of daily tasks. So we would wake up in the morning and we would pray together. And then we would read spiritual material together. And at night we would take inventory together, and we really started to we went back to the incredible friendship and relationship that we had always had, but we put God right in the middle of all of it, and it just changed everything. And so we became Catholic together. We joined the church together. Then we got married shortly thereafter. And then he went to war because he was a United States Marine. He went to Iraq first, and he was living outside the wire and doing some things. And IEDs, you know, were driven into the building where he was. And it was just a dangerous hot mess, as we all remember from news reports and things. I was just having a real personal experience with that. And while he's away at war, I then reach out to some AA members who I was familiar with, who had an additional. They had been practicing living in the presence of God, not just having a prayer life and not just participating in meditation, but actually working on seeing God all day long, and having a conversation that never ended. And so I connected with them and I said, "How do you do that? Because there are people shooting at my husband on purpose and I'm not okay." Mm. And so I picked up the practice of searching for and communicating with the presence of God all day long. And it changed everything for me spiritually. And he came home from Iraq, and then the deployment to Afghanistan got moved up. So he was only home for a few months, and off he went to Afghanistan. And he was the XO of 2nd Battalion, 7th Marines. And so there's, you know, 1,200 men go over, and they take the fight to the Taliban out in Helmand Province, which is a place we had not yet been. And it was awful. It was just awful. It was very difficult. And I was, again, I was his best friend. And so anytime he could call or email or anything, he would reach out and he would tell me the truth. And because of the kind of spiritual conversation that he and I had, I could say things to him like, "What can I take into prayer on your behalf? What can I lift up to God? What kinds of spiritual answers can I seek while you're fighting?" And so we got to have that kind of conversation. But I tell you, it was hard. I mean, there were days when I would see another email and I didn't want to open it, because I opened an email one day and it said, "Another IED, honey, nothing left but a boot. 4 more men are gone." Those kinds of emails, because he told me the truth. Mm. And so I got to take all of that into this spiritual, prayerful movement with God while he is away in Afghanistan. And so I am deepening my relationship with God, and I'm deepening my relationship with him, and he's fighting and it's hard. And he makes it home. He comes home. But it was the It was the bloodiest deployment any battalion for the Marines had had to date. And he came home and he was angry and he was hurt. And he would relive some of those things. And it took us a long time to get him to come all the way home. And we did things like, you were talking about riding motorcycles earlier, right? He was able to take a couple of weeks off. And I said, we're just going to go for a ride. And we took off for a couple of weeks. And I made every decision because he had had to make big, sometimes life-changing or life-sustaining decisions nonstop for months. And so when he got home, he didn't have it left in him to make another decision. And so we went right when I wanted to go right and went left when I wanted to go left. We slept when I got tired. We ate the food that I chose for us. I didn't ask him to weigh in on any of it.
Mm-hmm.
We just rode. And you know, we rode our own motorcycles, right? And so I got to spend time with my husband, and he got to spend time not making any decisions. And one day, like, we were riding down the road, and I was pulling into a Mexican restaurant, and he said, what are we doing? And I said, I'm hungry. We're going to get some lunch. And he said, I don't want Mexican. And I was like, well, what do you want? And he said, I want pizza. And I said, welcome home. And little by slow, you know, he came all the way home, and he was home for about 5 months. And I was working for the Marines at the time. And, anyway, I only worked a 14-hour day. He worked a 16-hour day that day. So I got home a little earlier than him, and I ate some dinner, and I was waiting up for him so that I could sit with him while he ate. And I fell asleep sitting up. And then all of a sudden I was startled awake, and I knew that something wasn't right and he wasn't there. And I called the base, and one of the captains answered, and I said, what are you doing there? And he said, Deb. And I said, yes. I said, you know, Captain. And I gave his name. I said, what are you doing there? I said, have you seen Lee? And he didn't know what to say. And I said, what's happened? And he said, I can't say. And I said, I need you to tell me. And he said, Deb, Colonel Reed is on his way to your house. And I said, what happened? And what happened was that Lee was on his way home that night between the base and our house. And about a quarter of a mile from our house, he was in an automobile accident and he died. And at that moment, I'm standing in the kitchen. And because I had been practicing living in the presence, because I had revisited my third step, and I had surrendered to the realm of the spirit in a really meaningful and deep and different way, a prayer began in me. I didn't choose to pray. A prayer just began in me. And I just said, God, I know you're here and I can't breathe. And God wrapped himself around me. And what I heard him say was, I'm here. And that was that. And my husband was gone, and the Marines came. And in the middle of the night, we're sitting up and we're talking, and they're telling stories about him on deployment when we're all not crying. And the sun starts to come up. And in the middle of the night, I sent out 3 text messages, right? One to a member of my current home group, another to one of my best girlfriends in New Orleans, who's connected to everyone I know, and another to the home group I had just left when I moved from one state out to where I was living then. And I'm sitting out with Colonel Reed, and the sun is coming up. And I said, oh my God, John, there's something you need to know about me that you don't know. And he was like, well, what is it? And I said, I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been sober for 22 years. And he said, okay. And I said, John, what that means is that they're coming. He said, they are? And I said, yes. I said, members of Alcoholics Anonymous will be here as soon as that sun comes up. They will be here. And he said, well, how do you know? Did they call? And I said, no. But I sent the information last night, and some of them are early risers, and they'll be here. And he said, okay. And I said, John, when they get here, I said, I know that you're used to the Marines running everything in circumstances like this. I said, but they're going to take over everything. and I said, you're just going to have to let them. I said, and it's going to feel chaotic to you because these people don't look like the people you're used to hanging out with. And he said, okay, well, does this group have a leader? And I said, oh my God, you'll know who she is the moment she arrives.
Jay.
Yes. And what happened through all, and I, you know, and I often talk about this experience, not because I'm the only one who has been widowed and stayed sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, but because I, you know, there are moments, and there will be more moments in my life too, I'm certain, where I am going to have to rely on the relationship I have with God today in this moment and not rely on the relationship I wish I had. Mm-hmm. And because I had the kind of relationship with God that I had at the time, I was able to go into and move through my grief. I was able to continue to be honest about where I was and how I was feeling and what I was thinking. I was able to grieve out loud with my home group. My home group came and we are just terrible at trying to, you know, figure out what people need when they're in a moment of grief, right? Like we rely on the person who's grieving to tell us what they need.
Right.
I mean, we just do. We humans, we're just something. Anyway, and so I hired one of my home group members and I handed her my phone and I said, I need you to just take a message from everybody that calls and try to answer the question. And if you can't, just jot the question down and we'll figure it out later. And I took another home group member and I said, look, my house needs to remain clean and the dishes need to remain done because there are going to be a lot of people in and out of here for at least 2 weeks. I just need you to run my house. And I gave it to another guy and I said, look, I'm going to need you to just park cars, hire the other guys, get them busy and just manage the street so the neighbors don't get mad. And I took one of the Marines and I said, I don't know what it is you're supposed to do, but just go do it for me. Yes, ma'am. I mean, just like people just go take care of things. And one of the most amazing things that happened is, so the next day, he was killed on a Tuesday night. And the next day, I'm in my kitchen and my old timers are sitting with me. And we're having a conversation. And they had all had an experience of grief, obviously, right? If you live long enough, it will visit all of us. Mm-hmm. And one of them said, and Deb, when you get really angry about this, go ahead and give that anger to God. He is big enough. He can handle it. You know that. Just put it on his shoulders and allow him to do that. But give your anger to him so that you don't have to carry it. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't want to be angry with God because I know that anytime I put anger in the middle of any relationship, I diminish the relationship. I know that. I've had that experience. And I don't want to be angry with God because I have this amazing relationship with God. So I don't want to do it like that, but I don't know how to do that any other way. And my friend Christine, who has the phone, she walks in the kitchen while I'm sitting there quietly thinking, there has to be another way. And she brings me the phone and she said, Deb, there's this old timer on the phone and his name is Walter from Houston. And he says he has a message for you from God. And I said, yes, 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 give me the phone. So I take the phone from her and it's Walter. Now, and Walter is an old Vietnam era Marine. And so he and Lee were big fans of one another too, right? And Walter is the guy that delivered the message when I was in Louisiana, right? Which started all this mess, by the way. I blame him. So Walter gets on the phone and he said, darling, I love you. I said, I love you too, Walter. He said, I am so sorry. I said, thank you, Walter. And he said, but look, I was sitting here in meditation and God told me to call you right now and to tell you that there are things that happen in this world that break his heart. Lee's death was one of those things. And he is going to be grieving alongside you. So you are to continue to rest in his arms.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, that's the other way. I don't have to be angry with God. I don't have to turn my back on God. I don't have to separate myself. I don't have to step out of the realm of the spirit because I'm in this kind of pain. What I have to do is what I had been doing to get through those two wartime deployments and to show up for my husband and help bring him the rest of the way home from war. I had to rest in the arms of God and be spiritually led, even though I was in that much pain. And it changed everything.
Right.
Changed everything. And I got a hold of like everybody in my house, and I said, people, there will be no more talk of me getting angry with God. We are not going to get angry with God. I said, we are going to walk step by step alongside God while we walk through the pain that we are all feeling because we've lost Lee. Am I clear? And they all went, yep. And that was that. And we literally, we had this spiritual flow that was not always pretty. It was not always graceful at all. But we did it. And we walked together. And we healed. All of us. The Marines, the AA members. I mean, I had AA members had keys to our house. Like Lee would get home from work. I wasn't even there. And there'd be AA members hanging out in our backyard. Because of step 6 and 7, I have the ability to live in this incredible community. I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous member in good standing. And if you're in my life, you're going to be all the way in my life. You know, the members of my home group, they didn't have to ask directions to my house when I needed them the most because they had already been there. Mm-hmm. They'd been there doing yard work, and they'd been there for the birthday parties, and they had been there for, you know, everything. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have to figure out how to get in my house. They just needed to come. And, you know, when I was about a year and a half sober, Mac and Jane died within a couple of months of each other.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they were both dying of lung cancer, emphysema. They were, you know, lifelong smoking.
Right.
You know, what happened to all the old timers back in the day? And they die anyway. And Mac went first. And I was just distraught, right? I mean, I'm a year and a half sober. I don't have skills for this. And so I'm pacing one night at a meeting, and I looked at, and I was like, I need to do something. Like, I need to do something. I am sad. I need to do something. And they said, well, go to Mac's house, knock on the door, and tell his widow that you're there to be helpful and see what happens. And I was like, fine. So I go to Mac's house, I knock on the door, and it occurs to me that I don't know her name, because Mac would always refer to her as Mother Superior. Anyway, I knock on the door. You know, I finally get to her, right? And I said, are you Mrs. Shadburn? She said, yes, I am. And I said, my name is Deb. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm here to be helpful. And she said, okay, honey, what can you do? And I was like, yikes, like, I don't really have any skills. Right? But because they had made me the coffee maker, right? I looked at her and I said, I can make coffee. And she said, okay, honey. She said, why don't you come in and you just keep the coffee fresh because lots of people will be coming. And I said, yes, ma'am. And so I went to her house for several days in a row, and I posted up by the coffee pot. And I kept the kitchen clean, and I kept the coffee fresh. And I was just there to be of service.
Yeah.
And the beautiful thing is, so fast forward 20 years, and I wake up out of a nap on like the second day after Lee is gone. And I walk out in the kitchen, and there's a girl, and she's pacing back and forth in front of the sliding glass door in my kitchen. And I look at her, and I went and I popped the door open, and I said, can I help you? And she said, my name, I think it was Sarah. She said, my name is Sarah. My sponsor, Christine, sent me over, and I'm here to be helpful. Are you the widow? Now, that was the first time anyone had called me that. And I said, yes, I am. And she said, well, I'm here to be helpful. And I said, well, what can you do? And she just threw her hands up and she said, you know, I really can't do much. I don't have very many skills, but I can make coffee. And it was one of those moments like, oh God, you are showing off, aren't you? And I said, well, Sarah, why don't you come in here and post up by that coffee pot because people are going to be coming in and out and keep the coffee fresh. And she said, I can do that.
Oh.
And she showed up for several days in a row, posted up in my kitchen and tended the coffee pot. And I was like, oh my God, it's all connected. We are all connected. Yeah. The life, the realm of the spirit is so rich and God is so faithful. It's really been an amazing journey.
So, all right. So we're probably going to have to schedule some more time at some other point. This has been great. I absolutely love it. So just to kind of wrap it up, is there some way that you would like to put a bow on it? Or do you just want to end there? Is there anything else that you want to say before? Keep in mind, you're going to have a lot of people listening to you, some that are looking to get sober, some that have been sober, some are like sober curious, as they call it nowadays. Anything else that you want to say before we drop off and read from How It Works? Excuse me, page 164.
Yeah, I guess the thing that I would say is that the broad highway, right, into the spiritual life really is broad, roomy, and all-inclusive, right? When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I didn't even know that God was real or that God existed, and I didn't know how to pray. And now I'm sitting here with 36 years of continuous sobriety, and I have a deep and effective and current and active relationship with a God who I don't understand well at all, but I cannot deny the body of evidence that he is alive and well and working in my life and in all of your lives. And I can honestly tell you that you could not have convinced me of that when I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought that you were all just a little bit cracked about this whole religion thing. And it took me a while to believe that you really weren't trying to talk me into joining a religion. You were really trying to talk me into the arms of God. And you didn't care. You really didn't care how I conceptualized God at all. You just wanted me to know that I wasn't God and that there was a power in this world greater than me that had my best interest at heart. Mm-hmm. And that was enough to start. And so, you know, your spiritual path may not be the same as my spiritual path. It doesn't matter, nor do I care. What I care about is that everyone who's listening has a relationship with God as misunderstood as it is. I really wish, if I could talk to Bill Wilson about one thing, the founder who wrote the majority of the Big Book, I wish it said God as we experience him instead of God as we understand him. Mm. Because the more experience I have, the more convinced I am that God is everything, but the less I understand him. Because he's far more vast.
I love it. Thank you very, very much, Dev H. from Akron, Ohio. I'm going to go ahead and wrap it up here today with page 164 from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says, abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Once again, Deb, that was absolutely fantastic, and I know everyone's going to enjoy that. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Absolutely fantastic. I know that you are going to want to hit that little pause button on your device and share that episode and Deb's previous episode with another friend, with a friend or family member. It may be just what they need today. Once again, Deb H., thank you for taking time out of your schedule to share your experience, strength, and hope. It was an absolute pleasure. Now, on to a little bit of listener feedback. Jess writes in and just says, hi, John. My name is Jess T. I am from British Columbia,
Canada, the Great White North. She said, I wrote to you in January of 2023, just after I had relapsed. I struggled for a few months after that. I don't know why exactly, but I thought I would like to write to you again, since today is my first ever year sober anniversary. Well, congratulations, Jess. That is fantastic. I celebrate one whole year today, and tomorrow I'm taking a cake at my home group. At one point, I had given up hope I would ever get to say those words. You know, Jess, there's a lot of people listening to this, and also myself, who thought the exact same things. I've talked about this on the pod in the past, but you know, I was 3 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I picked up 10 to 12 desire chips. The last time I just threw them all away because I thought it wasn't working. I thought that I was one of those people that was constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. But the thing that I did right is I just kept getting back up on that horse and riding it. And it sounds like you did the same thing, Jess. I'm so glad for you. Anyway, Jess goes on. Sober Speak has been a huge part of my sobriety. I listen every week to the new episodes and recommend them to friends and newcomers. I just wanted to say thank you, John. I hope that you know that your work is impacting people all over the world. You probably had no idea that you were such an integral part of the life of one alcoholic 35 kilometers away. She says that's 2,175 miles. Sorry for the Canadian. She says, but you have been. You and all your guests have inspired and encouraged me, given me a new perspective and motivation, and above all, helped me to learn about the steps and how to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. I cannot express how grateful I am for what you do. Anyways, I hope you're having a wonderful day. I am on my way to my home group now, where I will celebrate by helping to train a new member to chair the meeting. Yours in love and service, Jess. Jess, I wrote you back. I think I told you this. I had goosebumps as I was reading your message, and God bless you. Congratulations. And, you know, I know that the vast, vast majority, you know, including myself, I don't sit down and write letters to podcasts even after they impact me and the people on them. And maybe I should more often, but that's the kind of key thing that keeps us going. And I thank you for taking time out of your schedule to write me. Anybody else who wants to write in with anything on your mind, I'm at John, J-O-H-N, at SoberSpeak.com. God bless you, Jess. Hillary writes in and she says, hi, John M. I thought I would send you these verses today. She sent in a, anyway, and here are the verses. The first one is from Deuteronomy 31:6. It says, be strong and courageous. Do not fear or be in dread of them, for it is the Lord your God who goes before you. He will not leave you or forsake you. Deuteronomy 31:6. And then the second one is, trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not lean into your own understanding. Proverbs 3:5-6. And as I told you when I wrote back, Hillary, I definitely took time to soak those in. I appreciate you. You didn't have to do that, taking time out of your day to write in like that. And it's just so wonderful to hear from you. And you know, it is interesting how I have a tendency to lean into my own understanding as opposed to God's. And it is interesting how I think that many times God has forsaken me, and he's not there, and he doesn't understand the plan. But I just have to step back and realize that he's with me. He's with all of us. And I appreciate you writing that in. And then Hillary goes on, your family and friends and the program of AA are always there to lift you up and encourage you with love and prayers, exclamation point. Thank you for your pod. And thank you for always sharing from the heart. God is with you. Blessings to you and Mrs. M and your kids. Hillary C. from San Diego, California. Now, we have thought a couple times, Hillary C., could that be Hillary Clinton, right? Out there, just, I mean, maybe she's in San Diego, California at this moment. But I know it's not. We've actually seen Hillary on, she used to come to our yoga class that we had every week. And I think she's been on a couple of the live events as well. So unless Hillary Clinton's putting on a disguise, that is not Hillary Clinton. But hey, Hillary Clinton, if you're out there listening as well, come on into the community, the Sober Speak community. We'd love to have you as part of our community. All right. Peter writes in, he says, hey, John, I love listening to you and your many fine members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Fine members. Yeah, some of them are questionable. Especially like, I don't know, my friend Casey. I don't know if he's a fine member or not. Anyway, he says, I have been tasked. That's a hard word to say, at least for me, with the challenge of finding speakers for my group on Zoom, A Design for Living, which is the name of the group. And he gives me the Zoom link and the passwords. And it is on 10 a.m. and 8 p.m. daily. Our speakers meetings is 8 p.m. on Saturdays. Anyway, the reason I'm reading this is because I want to follow it up with a comment. He said, I was hoping that you would be able to help with the current contact information of some of your guests. Thank you, Peter G. from, another Canadian, St. Thomas, Ontario, Canada, the Great White North. Well, Peter, as you know, I responded to you. Here's what it comes down to. If you're out there, if there's somebody else out there, not you, Peter, you already know, and you're looking for speakers for your meeting and you want to contact me at John, G-O-H-N, at soberspeak.com. Let me know, you know, what you're looking for. If you need speakers for your meeting, I can pass it on to the folks who do that stuff here on SoberSpeak. Most of them will find the time to do it. I usually have an idea of who may not find the time, but I can give you their email or whatever the case may be, and you can reach out and set that up for your meeting out there in the Hitherlands. Hitherlands. Is that a real word? Or is it Netherlands? It's come hither. It's not, I don't know. I can't get it. But anyway, hey, that wraps up another ep. And I know that you enjoyed Deb H part 2. And what else do I want to say? Keep coming back. It works if you work it. I take this 1 week at a time. I'm hoping to be back next week. And may God bless you and keep you until then. Love you guys. Bye-bye.